You're listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com worldwide. Freedom is never free. We need your support today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. The number to call in during this live broadcast is 1-800-858-6582. If you have unlimited long distance or are calling from a cell phone, please use our toll number, 1-559-733-5161. That's 1-559-733-5161. Thank you.
Another broadcast called American Exposé, and certainly I'm here live again Thursday, the 29th of July, moving quickly into August. Oh boy. August, then September, then October, then November. Time just flies, and the New World Order just keeps moving along. And where is the New World Order situated? Good question. Very controversial question. But, things keep moving along. The blood and guts sort of kind of fall to the wayside when the elections are going on. Or shall I call it the selections? We have the elections out here in Oklahoma, just like you have your elections in your state. But they are all talking about unity. What kind of unity are they talking about? Here you see in this one little section here about former U.S. Representative Tom Coburn captured outright the Republican U.S. Senate primary Tuesday, trouncing two well-known and well-financed candidates and dealing a blow to the old guard Oklahoma GOP establishment. What do they mean by this? Coburn, a Muskegee doctor, received more than 60% of the vote and will face Democratic Representative Brad Carson. Well, maybe this individual, Coburn, might not be so bad. We'll have to find out. At this stage of the game, it seems like it is a game, a serious game, a game for money and finances. I've covered some of this already. But another article expressing the direction of the corridors is in last Thursday's paper. And this is all coming together slowly but surely as the funds appear. This is the ex-official sees gains for state in truck route. They talk about Oklahoma benefiting from the Trans-Texas Corridor. This is according to former Oklahoma Transportation Authority Director Neil McCaleb. And this is the long-range 50-year, $186 billion plan that he's talking about. And, boy, I'll tell you, when things happen, when stuff goes on, people just don't seem to get the picture in place. And that's the sad commentary about it all. Most don't have a clue. Aaron's here tonight, and maybe it would be nice to hear some phone calls, get your input on things this week. Nice to know there's intelligent people listening and paying attention. Very, very important to do that at times. Well, I'll tell you, whenever I come on the air, my computer goes crazy. It's just amazing. Supposed to be getting a new one. That would be nice. Anyway, this McCaleb, he's now, who was the former Transportation Authority Director for Oklahoma, he's now the consultant for Chang, Patel, and Yerby Incorporated. And they're one of the companies being considered to implement the Texas project. And he focused on the first phase of the plan, known as the Mexico to Oklahoma project. The project consists of a 1,200-foot-wide, four-lane truck route, and possibly could extend from the U.S.-Mexico border near Laredo, Texas, into Oklahoma. Well, ultimately, this country is going to be inundated with corridors. Everywhere you look, there's going to be corridors, and there's going to be roads closed down as well. That's the problem. Quote, Oklahoma is at the crossroads of opportunity. That's what McCaleb says. That's an end quote. And the transportation corridor, once again, is a 50-year vision for the future of transportation. The 4,000-mile network would tie central roads, high-speed roads, and utility lines across Texas and its neighbors. This all sounds good in the long run, but why? They want to have separate truck routes so they can pull 3 and 4 trailers. They'll be integrated away from, actually segregated away from the regular traffic. And that's the plan. With those thoughts in place, let's continue with this. McCaleb said the corridor will have an economic effect in Texas and other cities. He said the truck lanes, which have greater load capacity, would allow tractor-trailer rigs to have 2, 3, or more trailers. He said staging areas would switch yards, could be built near the larger cities to allow the trucking companies to switch to 1 trailer. Benefits would include less wear on existing roads and safer highways, he says. At that expense, is that important? Though the location of the corridor has not been determined, estimates show the route would be about 700 miles long in Texas. In Oklahoma, from the Red River to Tulsa, the corridor would run about 130 miles, they say. When you do research on the corridors, you go to NASCO, the North American Superhighway Coalition, you'll see what's going on and being implemented. That is your responsibility if you want to find these things out. Most don't care, most don't pay attention. Most continue to be non-believers in what's being implemented here in America and in the past. I'm sorry to be an apologist for our country, which I'm not, but sometimes I sound like it. There are things being implemented, things going on, totalitarian control being engineered that most people have no clue about. And that is the problem. As I did the shortwave broadcast for discount gold and silver trading today, I got into this whole setup situation that we live today and the engineering of closing of land for certain purposes. It's just incredible how easy it is to document how things are how things are coming down. And that is the problem that we have today, people. Where is it going to stop? Who's going to stop it? Are the elections going to make a difference? I'm just so sorry to say that without this Federal Reserve, we would be a lot better off. Without this UN system, the whole world would be better off. But the implementation process of all this is you know, it's in your face, and they tell you in these government think tanks that you might as well just go along to get along. You're not going to be able to stop it. Well, here we see from The Guardian, dated September 19th, last year, 2003, the International Monetary Fund warned that the colossal United States trade deficit was a noose around the neck of the economy, emphasizing that the once mighty dollar could collapse at any moment. That was last year. Arguing that the world's biggest economies were already too dependent on the willingness of American consumers to live beyond their means, the IMF said the U.S. could not continue to run a current account deficit of 5% of the GDP. What does that mean to you? How is that making any sense? The IMF's chief economist, Kenneth Rogoff, said that it was just a matter of time before the gap closed, tipping the dollar into a potentially steep fall. Where are we today with that? A year later, just about. Quote, if we're looking at a poor developing country, the world gives them just enough rope to hang themselves. A country like the United States, they give them enough rope to tie the noose around their neck several times, but it does happen in the end, end quote, he said. Our Secretary of the Treasury is the U.S. Governor of the IMF. In its twice yearly report on the world economy, the fund warns that even a controlled slide in the dollar's value is likely to slow U.S. growth, and unless other countries pick up the slack, the global economy would suffer. Remember, when September 11th happened, S-11, George Walker Bush said the global economy would continue. No stopping the global economy. Mr. Rogoff said the collapse of world trade talks last weekend in Cancun would spell disaster for a global economy already too dependent on unbalanced growth in the U.S., describing the breakdown as a tragedy, he said global poverty would rise if protectionism took root in the world's biggest economies. Ah, there's a threat. If you go sovereign, you're going to have problems, they're saying. Wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and heightened geopolitical tensions worldwide after September 11th attacks on the U.S. would unquestionably hold back growth in the decades ahead, Mr. Rogoff told reporters. So what are we doing over there now? We're in a mess. We don't know who our enemy is. We're disarming the population. At the tune of how many billions of dollars is this costing? Where's the money coming from? And will our taxes be affected by it? Did we have a say in what was going to happen? Did we have a say in what happened in Pearl Harbor? Did we have a say in the sinking of the Lusitania to get us into the First World War, which took several months to get into, almost a year later? Actually, almost 2 years later. A lot of awake people back then, in 1915, 1916, probably a lot of outraged people knowing that we were part of a central bank called the Federal Reserve in 1914. The report was highly critical of Europe's stagnating economies, blaming governments for failing to embrace deep structural reforms of their labor. markets and welfare states. Quote, reforms to improve the competitiveness of European labor and product markets could yield significant dividends in terms of regional output, end quote, the report said. It also warned that an over-rigid application of Europe's fiscal rulebook would push the Eurozone deeper into trouble. Chancellor Gordon Brown echoed the IMF's criticisms of the Eurozone in an article in yesterday's Wall Street Journal, arguing that the credibility of Europe was at stake. What kind of manipulation is this all about? Sovereignty has been taken away from the European countries into the European Union, which Mikhail Gorbachev was a Sovietization process. It's the new Soviet. That's what Mikhail Gorbachev said. Demanding wide-ranging change in policies, quote, that have held back our continent for too long, Mr. Brown added. Reform is not desirable. It is an urgent necessity, end quote. Have we felt any repercussions since September 19, 2003? The chancellor said, quote, having created a single market in theory, we should make it work in reality and help it spread competition, cut prices, increase consumer choice, and deliver higher productivity, end quote. Where's the higher productivity coming from? The impact of the stalled trade talks in Mexico on the fragile global recovery will dominate this weekend's annual meeting of the IMF and the World Bank in Dubai. Marvin King, the governor of the Bank of England, said yesterday, quote, the failure of the talks in Cancun will cast something of a cloud over the meeting. That is not a happy background in which to assess the durability of the recovery, end quote. They go on to state misalignments between the world's biggest currencies are also likely to feature on the agenda, with the U.S. hoping other countries will support its campaign to get China to strengthen its currency, the yuan. Following an upgrading of its growth prospects by the fund, the U.S. is expected to expand by 2.6% this year, the fastest in the Big Seven economies. China, always China. Communist China is where it is and what it is. And that is the sad commentary that we live today. China is the second biggest economy in the world now. Am I wrong when I say that? Somebody tell me I'm wrong. Maybe even the largest economy in the world. You know, it's a sad commentary that we live today where our sons and daughters and fathers and mothers are going off into these wars and they're talking about for our freedom. It has nothing to do with our freedom. It has everything to do with getting our military out of this country. And when we have a crisis in this country, who's going to come to our rescue? And they're going to outright say, our resources are too skimpy. We need help. And then NATO comes in to control whatever chaos is brought about here in America. Think about what's happened in the past. Think about Bosnia-Herzegovina and all that portion over there, Kosovo and all. What do you have? Bosnia-Herzegovina, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Croatia, the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, Serbia and Montenegro, Slavonia. Listen to this quote. Our vision of Europe must also include the Balkans. Unlike the people of Poland, many people and leaders in Southeast Europe made the wrong choices in the last decade. There, communism fell, but dictators exploited a murderous nationalism to cling to power and to conquer new land. Twice NATO had to intervene militarily to stop the killing and defend the values that define a new Europe. Today, instability remains, and there are still those who seek to undermine the fragile peace that holds. We condemn those, like the sponsors of violence in Macedonia, who seek to subvert democracy, but we've made progress. We see democratic change in Zagreb and Belgrade, moderate governments in Bosnia, multi-ethnic police in Kosovo, the end of violence in southern Serbia. For the first time in history, all governments in the region are democratic, committed to cooperating with one another, and predisposed to join Europe. Across the region, nations are yearning to be a part of Europe. What did Mikhail Gorbachev say? The new Soviet is the European Union. The burdens and benefits of satisfying and yearning will naturally fall most likely or most heavily on Europe itself. That is why I welcome Europe's commitment to play a leading role in the stabilization of Southeastern Europe. Countries other than the United States already provide over 80% of the NATO-led forces in the region. But I know that America's role is important, and we will meet our obligations. We went into the Balkans together, and we will come out together, and our goal must be to hasten the arrival of that day, end quote. That's a statement by President George Bush to the faculty and students of Warsaw University in Warsaw, Poland, June 15, 2001. And what is the emphasis? We supplied 80% of the troops in NATO. Our military did. And all this is being engineered for the UN system. I keep saying this, and it's just the way it is. This information comes from the State Department. I mean, we're concentrating on Iraq, and all these other countries have been put under the umbrella because they've already been bombed into subservience. They've already been brought to their knees. The people of these countries disarmed. We're not hearing the truth about what's really going on over there. We don't know what the casualty list is of all the civilians that died. That is the problem that we have today. There's people in the State Department, Mark Grossman, Undersecretary for Political Affairs, who's made a speech, a press speech, in Kosovo on March 29, 2004. He says, "I apologize for keeping you waiting. We were just in what I consider to be a very interesting and successful meeting with the PISG, which is the Provisional Institutions of Self-Government, coming out of Kosovo, people. Let me make a short statement, and then I'll be glad to answer a few questions. I came to Kosovo to add my voice to those of the NATO Secretary General, representatives of the European Union, the Secretary General of the United Nations, and others, to say that the recent violence in Kosovo is unacceptable and that it is a dead end for the people of Kosovo and for the people of the region. and to say that all of the clarity, to say with all the clarity that I possibly can, that this violence must never be repeated, I came also, as you might imagine, to express again the condolences of our government to those who suffered injury, to those who died, to those who lost property. Our heads go out, or our hearts go out to the families for what they have suffered. Well, isn't that interesting? Once again, this Mr. Grossman is chiming the voice of Secretary General of NATO, Representative of the European Union, and Secretary General of even the United Nations. The violence over there is the resistance of the UN system is what they're fighting against. The Hegelian dialectic brings itself to fruition when you understand what's happened. We don't get the truth without being there. And this Kosovo situation, as the whole Bosnia and Herzegovina situation, that whole European area will be suckered into the European Union if it hasn't already done so. Part of it has. But we're keeping our eye on Iraq now, aren't we? We're keeping our eye on Israel and the Gaza situation. And that is a sad, sad commentary. That is the way it's being engineered for us at this point in time, that we have to succumb to directions whether we like it or not, because we're so far into this UN system. Where is it going to stop? It's not going to stop. Unless enough people get engineered into understanding what's going on and how to stop it. Just say no to war. Well, as a result of what happened on September 11th, 2001, that's another Pearl Harbor, we have families being torn apart now, losing loved ones. There wasn't any place else to go to engineer totalitarian control because the Middle East was the last portion of the world for sovereignty. Japan isn't sovereign. Japan was an occupied country at the conclusion of the Second World War. That's why you have Standard Oil of New York or Sony. Germany the same way. When Germany was unified, what were they unified into? Democracy. What's democracy? Democracy, at least, is the code word for socialism. But when you have all 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto being engineered here in America, and nobody knows it, mostly, boy, I'll tell you, if people don't see the picture in place, and most of them don't, the other side's done their job very well. Most of you know that. Thank you.
opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests, and not necessarily those of the First Amendment Radio Network or its affiliated radio stations.
If you can hear my voice, you are listening to the Worldwide First Amendment Radio Network. If you would like to continue hearing these programs, there are several ways that you can help. One, you can make a donation or subscribe to your favorite program by going to firstamendmentradio.com on the internet and follow the instructions there. Two, you can sponsor your favorite program with your business advertising dollars or spend your dollars with those businesses that advertise on your favorite programs. Three, simply call in on live programs and tell them that you are listening on firstamendmentradio.com. Now anyone can do that one. You can find the call-in numbers on our schedule pages at firstamendmentradio.com. And finally, you can call 559-733-5002 and leave your name and address, and we will send you a support pack. Thank you for listening. Who are you? That is the question, and the name of the program. To learn what the question means and what the answers are, tune in every Sunday afternoon, and Rice McLeod will give you the answers. Who are you? Check the schedule pages at firstamendmentradio.com for broadcast times. We'll see you then. You are listening to the Worldwide First Amendment Radio Network. We do not have freedom of speech because the Constitution gives it to us. The constitutional amendment was written to keep the government from taking our freedom away. The Creator gave us our rights, but He also gives us the capacity to do evil or usurp the rights of others. Our individual rights end where the rights of another begin. No one has the right to do evil because evil can never be right. Those who would seek to limit your right to speak or hear the truth are the same who seek to subjugate, control, and enslave you. Freedom is not free. Support the Worldwide First Amendment Radio Network by going to firstamendmentradio.com on the internet and following the instructions there to support us, or call 559-733-5002 and leave your name and address, and we will send you a support pack. Thank you for listening.
I can go back and forth with what's going on, what's being developed, what's happening here. I'm going to try and do something now a little different tonight. And Aaron's taken off. Nobody's called, and that's pretty normal. Nobody seems to ever call when I do shows, and that's been the way it has been for about 8 years. Now, although, you know, you're welcome to call, and, you know, I'm perfectly willing to be attacked with whatever I do. It just doesn't seem to ever happen. The Vietnam War is something that can't be forgotten. And the directions, the despicable things that happened, the engineering process, and Vietnam did sign the Geneva Convention, by the way. Found that out tonight in the Pabst lawsuit against the federal government in 1976, and some of their corroborating information, the Geneva Convention. But I thought I ought to do this tonight, is rekindle this Bobby Garwood situation, because it was a traumatic thing, and it's a terrible time. The drugging down process was going on in America. The Stop the War was happening over here when we were over there not doing what we were able to do. And even the Discovery Wings channel was interviewing some of the pilots during the Vietnam War or actually after the Vietnam War, I mean just recently, talking about how they weren't allowed to bomb the structures that were helping to build the war in Vietnam. And they admitted the orders to do things in Vietnam came out of Washington. A set up war. Well, think of those that were left behind in Vietnam. Bobby Garwood was one of them. Back in 1998, I did a series of broadcasts with Bob Garwood and Colonel Tom McKinney, who at one time swore he wanted to kill Bobby Garwood. He was misinformed. Sad, sad commentary. But tonight might be a good time to get back into that a little bit, because Vietnam is a communist country under the umbrella of the United Nations right now. And this is Spite House 10, what I'm going to cover January 31st, 1998. And from Monica Jensen Stevenson's book, entitled Spite House, two U.S. Marines, both totally loyal to the same beliefs. One is turned into a hunter, and the other into prey. Such a distortion of patriotism would not be credible unless buttressed by hard facts and by the testimony of both men. In 1965, Marine Private Robert Garwood, 10 days short of the end of his tour, was sent on a mission from which he did not return. Ambushed by the Viet Cong, he was held prisoner for 14 years. And in 1979, he escaped and returned to the United States, where he was hastily court-martialed and convicted of collaborating with the enemy. Well, let's hear, and hopefully this works, bear with me. Let's listen to this, Spite House 10. That's Spite House, that was the 10th interview that I'd done with Bob Garwood and Tom McKinney. A few of those I did with McKinney by himself, and a few of those I did with Bob Garwood by himself. But this is the crux of the matter. This is after 1973. This interview covers after 1973, when Henry Kissinger said all our troops were home. Let's see how it works. Bear with me. Let's go with this right now.
But Tom, as I reported, Monica and I spent a good hour yesterday getting into the book Spite House.
Good.
And so we don't really have to travel back too far as how it all came about, his experiences in the POW camps with the spiders in the jar and whatnot. Doesn't necessarily have to be covered tonight as much as what happened after the Vietnam War at this point. And I think this is the most important thing to get into it right now, is just what did happen, as Bob Garwood was certainly an eyewitness to everything that did go on. And this is the problem where they said no POWs were alive at the remaining end of the war, were there? According to certain reports that we received.
Well, that's the public statement that Nixon and Kissinger made in the spring of 1973. And they both knew, at the time they made it, they both knew it wasn't true.
Yes. And that is that is certainly something that most of us realize at this point. And I have an open letter from Robert Garwood at the House Subcommittee on East Asian and Pacific Affairs, June 5th, 1985. And it goes here to state, I want to briefly outline what I know about American prisoners who are alive and being held against their will in Vietnam. Allow me to call to your attention the attached Washington Times article dated May 21, 1995, as an accurate summary of what I saw and heard of other Americans while I was in Vietnam. I am concerned that you, as congressmen, have not taken steps to bring my brother's fellow American prisoners home. It's time for you to outline what actions you have taken besides holding hearings and writing letters to rescue these live POWs. I fought communists in a war in Southeast Asia in which Congress walked away in 1973 and left me, as well as many other Americans, behind. I have been told repeatedly by officials of the U.S. government to be quiet and only privately discuss my knowledge of Americans that were held back by the Vietnamese. After almost 6 years of silence, I decided to publicly disclose my first-hand knowledge of other Americans still in prison camps in Vietnam. In a December 4, 1984 article in the Wall Street Journal, much to my surprise, I received little attention from Congress as a result of this alarming disclosure that I had seen 60 to 70 other Americans between 1973 and 1978. On March 22, 1985, I held a news conference in Washington, D.C., and gave names, dates, and locations of the other Americans I saw who were still in Vietnam to Congressman Bill Hinden for transmittal to President Reagan. To date, I am given to understand that the President's advisors have refused to permit a meeting between the President and Congressman Hinden to discuss the live POWs I saw. I cannot understand why a president who declared the POW-MIA problem to be this nation's highest national priority would allow his advisors to stop information from reaching him that I saw several other Americans still held prisoners by Vietnam. And I can go on, but at this point, that's enough. And Bob, you're still stuck with the same question in your mind, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
And here it is, 1998, and it's late. And the situation we have at this point is a vilification from the past, and now they just leave Bob alone. But Monica has written a wonderful book, Spite House, which she also co-wrote with her husband, Kiss the Boys Goodbye. And my main concern is, first of all, Tom, you might have something on the top of your tongue right now, probably.
I still believe that Ronald Reagan, who knew, incidentally, that there were live prisoners left over there, I still believe that he wanted to bring them home. And in his first term, he tried. He launched several clandestine operations, rescue operations, all of which were compromised and nullified by his own government at levels below him. And I think by the time of his second term in office, he realized that he simply didn't have the power to do it. He did say, after he was out of office, and I think this is a quote, if it isn't, it's close enough to be considered one. Time after time, he said, I issued orders only to have them nullified by people two levels below me. And if you look two levels below him, that's where you find the Brent Scowcrofts and the others who were committed to keeping this from the American people. They were committed to keeping the prisoners over there. And I know that listeners would wonder, how can anybody who calls himself an American, let alone a retired colonel or a member of the armed forces or a servant of the government, veterans, etc., how could they live with themselves? How could they justify this kind of evil, this kind of crime, this kind of sin? And I believe that for the most part, some of them are cynical enough that they don't care. They only are interested in what they can get out of it. But most of them, I think, justify this to themselves by saying that it's, quote, for the better good, quote. And they will say, if you were to speak with them privately about it, they'll say, look, if this truth were ever known, if the American people really did find out what was done in abandoning these men over there and then covering it up for all these years and persecuting and crucifying, in some cases killing those who tried to tell the truth, it would bring the country down. It would be the end of our system of government. It would be a constitutional crisis that couldn't be resolved. That's what they say, and I think a lot of them believe it. And so they decide it's better to have life go on here than to have a major crisis in the government. I think the American people would much prefer the major crisis in the government and clean the house and start over again than to have done what has been done, this treachery, this betrayal of its own fighting men, who trusted them and went to battle believing that they would never be abandoned.
Yes, that's certainly true. And it's certainly painful for us to think that there are men left behind And the reason Bob Garwood was left behind is because they assumed by his actions and the vehicle he was in and the sidearm he was carrying without a rifle that he was an intelligence officer, and that's why they kept Bob Garwood. And that's the problem that he had to live with, because he never had anything to say because he was a private first class, but yet he was given all the special attention that the intelligence people did receive. So a lot of pain, a lot of heartache, and this situation in 1973, when you, Bob Garwood, you heard Henry Kissinger make a speech. It was played over the loudspeaker system, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
And that speech was attuning to the fact that there were no prisoners left in Southeast Asia.
That's correct. Kissinger, in his own words, the communists played those the loudspeakers at the camp so all the prisoners could hear that Kissinger was competent, and U.S. government, U.S. people have been assured that all American prisoners of war, live American prisoners of war, had been returned home.
Mm-hmm.
And the communists deliberately played this over the loudspeakers so that we could hear, and they later used that as in their own propaganda, that the U.S. government cared nothing about you before, they don't care anything about you today. You have been written off, you are dead in the eyes of your country and your government.
And basically, go ahead.
They used this against us.
And
basically hoping that any resistance that we had left would be destroyed.
And more than likely, it did destroy quite a few people, didn't it?
Unfortunately, it did, yes.
Yes, it did. But you were, from 1973 to 1979, you were able to find a way to survive, and that was to repair the vehicles that were left behind. Was that correct?
That's correct.
You know, Chris, I think it would be really interesting and useful for the listeners to hear from Bob when he first even suspected that maybe he was going to be abandoned by his own country.
Good.
And what that did to him. And then when he actually knew and what that did to him, what he decided, how it may have changed his attitudes.
Very good.
Well, even up to 1973, you know, all prisoners, you know, after escape attempts have failed, then you live from day to day and try to hang on, and you resist. It's kind of like the bounce back. We call it the bounce back theory. You resist as much as you can. You give in a little bit so they'll stop whatever they're doing and resist again, and you keep this up. And in 1973, because you figure, well, you know, you got to rely on your government, that they know what they're doing. They know you're there. They're going to get you out by whatever means, no matter what it costs. And it was quite a blow when I wasn't released in 73. But then my captors assured me that when the U.S. withdrew totally, that I would be released back to my family.
When did you know in 73, though, Bob, that you were not going to be released with homecoming?
I did not know that until the announcement that the final stage had been completed of prisoner release.
And you were hearing that over the camp loudspeaker?
That's correct.
Uh-huh. Now I interrupted you.
Yeah, and I...
Go ahead.
And when I heard that, I asked the camp commander, why, how can that be? Why was that?
And he just laughed and said, well, do you think that Vietnam would be so stupid as to release all American prisoners back to the U.S.? If we did so, what would prevent the United States from bombing North Vietnam again?
Now, that was the camp commander who told you that?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so, I mean, that's without any outside news. Basically, the only news of anything is whatever came over the loudspeaker or what was told us by the camp guards or the camp commander. So life went on up until possibly May, April of 1975.
During that time, Bob, especially going back to when Tom was questioning you about at the initial occasion when the announcement was made that there were no more prisoners of war by Henry Kissinger, how many other American prisoners of war were around you at the time?
I was I was being incarcerated and held in prison complex called it was Camp 5. It was the Imbi prison complex. This was the same prison complex that held the prisoners that were captured at Dien Bien Phu, the French prison. It was a large prison system there. And in 73, when Kissinger said that he was satisfied that Vietnam had honored their agreement and returned all live prisoners, there were still 60 to 70 of us sitting there in the Camp 5 prison complex.
Uh-huh.
We were, except for small groups, most of us were all segregated from one another. What had changed is they no longer housed us together. They separated us. And I later found out that did that for the specific purpose, because if any of us got out, we would have little if no knowledge about the rest that were left behind.
You know, this is very interesting. Probably doesn't pertain, but there was a movie with Paul Newman called The Rack. I don't know whether you know about it or not, but
no.
It was about a POW in Korea that was isolated, and he was the one, supposedly, who collaborated with the enemy by signing papers, and he was court-martialed. But yet they found a way to get to this individual by keeping him completely isolated from everyone else. And they seem to have learned from that. This was a 1950s movie. It seemed to me they took a lesson from that and carried it over to our POWs in Vietnam. I'm sure it's not related, but it certainly is effective. It is a very effective way of demoralizing someone by keeping him isolated, isn't it?
Yes, it is. The when Ho Chi Minh was still alive, the prisoners were treated very brutally, physically, from beatings, physical torture, to executions. After Ho Chi Minh died, the policy changed. It went from physical abuse to psychological abuse, and that's what they did. They pitted each one of us against the other, sowing distrust amongst us. And unfortunately, it worked very well, because when they would torture us prior to that, when Ho Chi Minh was still alive, when they would torture us or beat us, what that did was it brought us all closer together in unity and strength. But so when they started using the psychological ways, means to control us, instead of us going closer together, we actually became very distrustful of one another. And that point, I think Monica probably mentioned last night, became the spiders in a jar syndrome, where we're fighting and bickering and distrustful of one another.
Yeah.
And basically, unfortunately, what has happened, we wouldn't believe what another American said, but we'd believe what the enemy said. And I still see that happening here U.S. government is relaying on to the American people what Vietnam has told them, and that's the gospel truth, not what the ex-POWs have said, not even just myself. Vietnam today is still denying, vehement denying, that they ever harmed, tortured, mistreated any American prisoner of war. Now, we all know that's a lie. And especially, and you know, the people that were there know damn well it was a lie. And I can't understand why that the American people, an American veteran, you know, no one believed the enemy, the Vietnamese, the communist Vietnamese, during the war. Why are they believing them now? What makes you think they have changed? It's still the same communist government regime and administration that killed, maimed, and tortured many, many of our American prisoners.
You know, Bob, in your own life, in your own case, it is true that they came to the place where they believed what the enemy said, but didn't believe what the other Americans said. And those other guys in the prison camp there in Quang Da believed what the guards and what the camp commander told them about you, but they didn't believe what you said.
That's true.
And that was one of the root causes of their being willing to testify against you at your court-martial.
That's true.
And but you're seeing on the grand scale now, here we are rushing to normalize relations and go on bicycle rides across Vietnam with senators and ambassadors and present to the American people what a lovely relationship this is, when it isn't true. And it has not been true. You know, Chris, you were talking about the change, the shift in communist treatment of prisoners.
Yes.
It's really historically a turning point. After World War II and the rise of the threat of the Eastern Bloc and the Communist Bloc and the Soviet Bloc, everything changed because of their godless worldview. Everything. And philosophically, there became no such thing as truth. Whatever was true was what best served the needs of the state, which means the power structure. And what was right and what was wrong were the things that best served the needs of the power structure or opposed it. And it was only in the Korean War, for the very first time, that American prisoners were subjected not just to physical brutality, but to psychological brutality, because for the first time, prisoners were seen as a gold mine for propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
The communists were not just trying to win wars, they were trying to win over the people of the world to their way of thinking.
That is very relevant today, as it was back then in 1998, January 31st. This is the interview I did with Bob Garwood and Tom McKinney, Spite House number 10, which was the 10th interview I'd done with them in a series. And certainly, you know, I don't feel comfortable getting them back on to talk about this. Because why bring up the past again and make it painful for Garwood himself? Although, if he's willing, we'll do it, but I don't think he is. Those are very painful times, as I said before.
Hi, I'm Pam Stegner. Do you want to garden organically, obtain insect control naturally, or care for your pet without harsh chemicals?